section. And that's kind of where we're jumping back into this morning. Many years ago, I had to have a very, very minor surgery. And I remember meeting the surgeon. I guess, I'm not sure if you'd call it like the pre-op. I don't know that that's what it was called. It was like an appointment. Go and meet him and have this discussion. I remember sitting, he was at a desk, and I was on the other side of the desk. And he was sitting there talking, explaining this little thing. And as he did, and I'm not making fun of him. This is just an actual recall. He was shaking, like his hands. He just shook. And there was a nurse in the room, and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, it's like, I don't know much about this stuff. All I knew is that probably whoever's going to have a scalpel shouldn't shake. And I think the nurse in the room saw my eyes because I just sort of, it's like I couldn't hear anything. All I can do is I just like staring at this guy, and I'm thinking like, this can't be, you know? It's like, that's what's going through your head. It's like, I don't think this is going to work. And so she's watching, and I'm watching him, and then the appointment ends, and she takes me aside, and she says, don't worry. She said, I just want you to know that when he operates, he goes completely calm. Okay. And I can actually attest to the fact, because it was not one of those, you know, fully out kind of things. It's like, as soon as it began, it's like any sense of tremor or shake, gone. Completely calm, completely still, did a phenomenal job. All that to say, if someone's going to operate on you, they probably should be competent. Are we agreed? Make sense? And if you can remember that, you're going to get at the heart of Elihu's speech to Job, which I would summarize like this, although these are my words, not Elihu's words. Job, from everything I can diagnose of the situation, Job, there's a problem with your heart. And Job, it might not have been there at the start. I'm not saying all this has happened because you are a sinner, but Job, through your suffering, some sin's been stirred up. And Job, I think God is using all of this to operate on your heart. And so, Job, I want to introduce you to your doctor, and I want you to know that your doctor is infinitely wise and powerful. And so, Job, rather than struggling against God, trust him. Now, that in like just a few sentences kind of summarizes a whole bunch, and he says it a lot better than that. But that's the essence, and I just want you to kind of have a bit of a sense of what Elihu's arguing, because he does it eloquently. He uses all sorts of figures of speech. He has all sorts of conversations to get there. But that's at the essence what these six chapters boil down to. Now, if you're kind of visiting with us, we're jumping in almost near the end of the book, a book where Job has wrestled with incredible suffering. And it's not so much that Job has denied God. It's more that he's wrestled with who is God. And what kind of a God is this? And is God actually just and good if he wouldn't step in and intervene? You see, because Job's questions aren't so much, is God powerful enough to do this? He seems very confident in that. And Job doesn't even go the direction that many of us do in our suffering or difficulties, which might be something along the lines of, you know what? Well, maybe I deserve it. Maybe I'm not that guy. I'm a really flawed, broken person. And so maybe this is just punishment and I had it coming too. I've had conversations with people who go that way. Job doesn't go that way. He, in fact, says something like this. I know I'm not the problem. I'm innocent. I've done nothing deserving of what's happened to me. And the only option that I can see left is that there must be a problem essentially with God. And then if we kind of follow through the book, Job's three friends have come along and they've tried to answer the question for Job and have essentially said, Job, you're wrong. That is not how this works, Job. The world is a very simple place. It's almost like a machine in its simplicity. Good people prosper. Bad people suffer because God is just. And Job, there's no exceptions. And so Job, we can kind of diagnose it. We can look at the symptoms and we can diagnose the condition. And so, Job, when we look at your life, you are suffering everywhere. There's no area of your life where you aren't suffering. So, Job, it pretty sort of seems clear that hidden deep down inside, there's sin. And Job, the problem is you refuse to admit it. And until you do, the suffering will continue. That's what the friends say, and Job just keeps saying, no, you're wrong, no, you're wrong, no, you're wrong. They do that for chapter after chapter. By the end of chapter 31, so the argument stops. And last week I introduced this new fellow, Elihu, who comes along and for six chapters begins to speak. Now, last week a lot of what I tried to do is just convince you that what Elihu is saying is worth listening to. So I gave, if you remember last week, we were here last week, I gave you nine reasons why I don't think this is like bad theology, that this is like another guy like the three friends who's misleading or directing Job in the wrong sort of direction. In fact, if you just start to look at chapter 42, verse 7, when the dust settles and God comes along, God actually singles out the three friends and says, you guys have been wrong. And it would have been the exact right moment, if Elihu was part of it, for God to have included him in that, but he doesn't. Instead, what it seems like to me in the flow of the book is that Elihu begins to answer Job, and God actually, he takes off where Elihu ends. Like, God sort of adds his answer to Elihu. In other words, Elihu starts down the right road and starts bringing some very important answers to Job in this whole matter of suffering, and I think they're probably important ones for us because sooner or later, we all get there. Sooner or later, we will suffer with something, and those same questions probably will be the ones that we wrestle with. Now, what's interesting is that even without any more information, probably we could live with that, in essence. If all we had was what we have up to the end of chapter 31, here's our theology. It goes something like, great God who's in control of all things. And he's just, but he's mysterious. He is beyond knowing for us. And so while we suffer, we'll probably never have answers. And so let's just kind of suck it up, grit our teeth, and grind it out, knowing that one day it'll all make sense. There's a lot of Christians who live that way. That's their theology of suffering. It's like we don't, it's all we got. The good news of the book of Job is it doesn't end in chapter 31. The good news is there is a whole lot more to say on this subject. And so let's get to work so that we can see what Elihu and then eventually in the next couple weeks what God has to say on this. In chapter 33, it's the first full speech. So as I mentioned, Elihu is going to deliver three speeches. One of them is in chapter 33, one is in 34, one's in 35, and then one actually is in chapter 36 and 7. So it's an odd chapter break, but those are the four speeches. In chapter 33, we looked at this one last week, Elihu essentially says this to Job. Job, you've tried to defend, you've spent a lot of energy defending your righteousness and very little energy thinking at all about the character and defense of God. And so you've actually got yourself to a place where you look pretty good in this whole story, and you've started to describe God in ways that make him look and sound less than what he truly must be. And Job, at the center of it all, is a claim that while you've suffered, the whole time God's been silent. That's been Job's argument. Why doesn't God just show up and speak? And he hasn't. Maybe you've been there in your suffering in those moments. Like, if God would just say something. Have you ever had those thoughts go through? Like, I could handle this suffering if God just showed up and said something and helped me understand it. Elihu comes to Job and says, Job, here's the problem. God has been speaking the whole time. What you don't understand, Job, is that God actually speaks through affliction. It's one of his ways. Now, there are other ways, and you can read, even Elihu will walk through those, but Job, you've missed so much. Because while you just railed against God, saying, God, why don't you speak? Why don't you speak? Why don't you speak? The whole time, Job, you are not right. Job, all these claims that you're good and God's not, because God's not speaking and you're innocent and that must make him something slightly less than, Job, you're just wrong. And you need to know it. Now, what's he wrong about? I think Elihu has both things in mind. Partly this claim to innocence, that he's overstated his purity. Job, you have made a really big deal out of the fact that you've done nothing wrong. You've been saying it for 30-some chapters. Second, you've made God out to be more like an enemy than anything else. And Job, you're wrong on both those things. You are not as good as you imagine, and Job, God has never been your enemy. Now, that's the essence of this chapter, and he gets to the point where he makes this massive point that we tried to make last week, and that's that God can have more purpose in suffering than just what we might understand being just simple punishment. Right? We go through suffering, and we go, what have I done to deserve this? This doesn't seem fair. What are we in essence saying? We're in essence saying, the only thing we can see or understand of what God might accomplish in suffering is punishment. And so I don't feel like I've been that bad. And so God must maybe not be that good. And that's been kind of where Job started to edge toward. And Elihu comes along and says, Job, the thing you need to understand is that God does other things in suffering. And that's the essence of speech number one that we looked at last week. And actually, as I go through it, I'm reminded of a place like John 9. Remember when the disciples come to Jesus and they find this man, he's been born blind, and their question to Jesus is, who sins? Right? They've got the exact same theology as Job's three friends. You hear that in it? It's like, here's a man that's suffering, so clearly he's being punished. We're just a little confused over who's getting punished. Was it him or his parents? But their theology is this nice, neat, wrapped with a bow on it, type of understanding of how God works. And Jesus' response is essentially similar in many ways to Elihu. It's like, that's not what's going on here. There's a whole other thing going on here that revolves around the glory of God. This is not a sin issue. This is a glory of God issue. And if you think back to Job's story, you'll see how similar it is. This is not a Job getting punished because of sin story. This is a glory of God story. And Elihu makes that argument in chapter 33. All right, he ends that and he moves into chapter 34, where Elihu is going to start to argue that God does, in fact, he is, in fact, just, and the wicked do, in fact, get punished. And he makes sort of a fairly big deal of that point through this whole second speech. God's a just God, and he rules with justice, and no one gets exempt. God doesn't play favorites. So even kings and great people, there's a level playing field, and God is just consistently across the board. And Job, this is sort of the application of Job by the end of the chapter 33 to 37. Job, if you want to be reconciled to God, if you want to be right with him, you need to do a couple things. You need to give up the claim that you're right, and you need to give up the claim that he's wrong. Because Job, that's at the heart of the problem. It's interesting, if you go to the end of the book in chapter 42, you see that's exactly what Job does. It's where the story ends. That's why, again, in part, I think Elihu is, he's not misguided at this. He sees with a clarity that no one else has yet in this story. Job, here's what's needed. Job, you need to understand, you are not who you thought you were. Now, through chapter 33 and 34, something really, really important starts to emerge, and that is that Elihu puts his finger on the exact issue of Job's heart, and it's pride. He says it point blank in 33, verse 17. He alludes to it all through chapter 34. And I'm not sure, my only question, and I'll just let you know what I haven't settled yet in these chapters, I'm not sure if pride is the key issue that God deals with all of us in suffering through, or if there's a multitude of issues, but for Job, this is the particular one, and God could deal with a multitude of issues. It's the only part I haven't decided, because it's so clear in the story of Job, what Elihu puts his finger on and says, Job, this is what God is working on in you. It's pride, arrogance, conceit, all the way through. It's that issue. And again, Elihu comes back to this point and says, Job, it might not have started out that you're suffering because you sinned. That's not how the story begins. But Job, somehow in all of this, something's been stirred up. You ever had like a bottle of water that's kind of been sitting a little bit? Maybe you hiked and kind of got this bottle. It looks really clear when you look into it. I could give you another analogy. It's not so pleasant. So we were sitting in our hot tub a couple weeks ago. It's been a while. And sitting there, and it looks lovely. It's like all clean. And then I turned on the jets. It's like, oh, it's like just about time to clean this thing out because it's stirred up all the stuff in the water, right? Maybe so you got your nice clean water bottle. That's a more pleasant analogy, right? And you're looking and it seems clean and then you shake it a little bit and all of a sudden all the sediment starts floating around. You're going, I thought this was clean, but wow, it's actually not nearly what I thought. That's Job. It looked pretty good. God commended him. This is an exceptional man, but under the pressure and strain and shaking of suffering, Elihu says, something, Job, is stirred up in your heart. And that something is pride. And Job, what I think is that all along, God's been at work. God's the surgeon. And he's operating, Job, in your heart. Now, that's sort of chapter 33. Wrestling again with Job's answer, but wrestling with sort of the bigger picture thing. And he delivers a theological argument. Do you want it? Just in case. For those of you who like this kind of thing, I'll give you Elihu's theological argument right in the center of this. It's a little bit hard to track with, so if I lose you, I'll tell you when we get to chapter 35. But if you got your Bible open, if you look at verse 13 to 15, this is sort of the key theological argument that Elihu's sort of claiming. Maybe I'll just back up a couple verses so we can track along with what he's doing. Therefore, I'm in verse 10. Therefore, hear me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness. Sort of hear what he's claiming? Job, God doesn't do wicked things. So Job, God's not in the wrong, okay? And from the Almighty that he should do wrong. So Job, God doesn't do wrong things. Verse 11, for according to the work of a man, he will repay him, and according to his ways, he will make it befall him. In other words, God is perfectly just. Of a truth, God will not do wickedly, and the Almighty will not pervert justice. Now that little thing, of a truth, it's an idiom, which means this is unthinkable. Now, we don't share that idiom, but it's just sort of a figure of speech. Of a truth, Elihu says, it's unthinkable that God would do anything other than that. All right, so why? Why is that unthinkable? And verse 13 to 15 is Elihu's theological argument. Who gave him charge over the earth and who laid on him the whole world? Right, this is his argument. Job, who delegated authority to God? Now, if you're sitting here going, I don't think anyone did. That's correct. No one did. But Elihu is like envisioning another scenario where you've got, say some great king who delegates authority to a lesser official. And the great king might be just and perfect in their ways, but the lesser official is slightly corrupt. And so while the king is just, the official down below starts to twist and bend justice to serve his or her needs. And Elihu says, in that kind of scenario, you can understand how the one who's administering justice might twist justice. But Elihu says to Job, that's not the scenario here, Job. No one delegated authority to God. He is supreme in his authority. And so, Job, if there is anything called justice, it has to come from the Creator. And if our Creator is not being delegated by authority by anyone else, then he actually must be just. Now that's, I know, isn't that sort of a bit of a, like, you got to think through what Elihu's claiming here. But this is sort of the heart of the argument. He goes on and says, if he should set his heart to it and gather to himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together and man would return to dust. So there's this theological argument. Job, God is the top of this chain. And if there's justice in the world, he has to be just. There's his argument. Now, okay, if I lost you, come back. You might want to have a conversation about that one later, going, okay, exactly how does that work itself out? But that's the heart of what Elihu's trying to claim here to Job. And in other words, he's saying, Job, don't forget, God is just. consistently across the board. That's the second speech. Chapter 35, the third speech, Elihu's going to continue with Job, and he's going to begin to imagine some of the things Job says, which is pretty common through the book. So he starts off, Elihu answered, verse 1, and said, "Do you think this to be just? Do you say, it is my right before God? That you have asked, what advantage have I? How am I better off than if I had sinned?" So Elihu imagines Job saying some of these things. He imagines Job saying, you know, it seems like I've been good, but it didn't gain me anything. And now I'm imagining that I could have been bad, and it might not have really affected things at all. And chapter 35 is an answer to that issue. It's not exactly the answer we might have said or anticipated. His answer is along these lines. Job, God is so far above you. Do you honestly think he's affected by that? Isn't that a puzzling answer? Now, the answer gets really to the heart of things by verse 7 and 8, and it comes out this way, where Elihu is saying this, Job, don't fall into the trap of thinking that if you do a whole bunch of stuff, God's in your debt. Because that's seemingly maybe one of the issues that's going on for Job. Job's like, God, I've done a whole bunch of good stuff. You owe me something better than this. And Elihu says, Job, that's not how the world works. God is great. He's far greater than that. He's not some sort of petty deity that you can force to become obligated to you. So Job, as you think this whole thing through, just think rightly about who God is. Now that's sort of the essence, I guess, of the third speech. And we're moving fairly quickly because we want to get to this final one. The final one where Elihu brings Job back to this issue of what God is accomplishing in his suffering. I'm just going to point out a couple verses that I think are really, really important. If you kind of flip ahead to verse 8, you'll see that Elihu is talking now about righteous people. He's not talking about wicked people. He talks about righteous people who are bound in chains and caught in cords of affliction. He's essentially talking about Job, a righteous man who's now caught in affliction. And here's what he says, verse 9. He then declares to them their work and their transgression, that they're behaving arrogantly. He opens their ears to instruction and commands that they be returned from iniquity. In other words, he says, Job, here's what God does. When you find yourself suffering, I think C.S. Lewis described it, God shouting in our suffering. It's a megaphone. And Job, here's what he says in those moments. He says, there's issues in our heart. Job, specifically for you, it's this issue of arrogance and pride. And Job, God has been speaking the whole time because it's essential that issue be dealt with. And so, Job, you think God's been silent, but Job, he's been talking to you this whole time saying, Job, there's an arrogance in your heart, there's a pride in your heart, there's a conceit in your heart that needs to be dealt with. And he goes on from this and he says, here's the difference, Job, between the godless and the godly. It's like suffering brings us to a fork in the road, Job, and you have a choice which path you're going to go down. The godless say, this is meaningless and I hear nothing. The godly say, perhaps in this God is speaking. Job, that's it. That's what it boils down to. And Job, the godless end up perishing in their anger. Well, they rail against God. They say, I can't hear anything. He's silent. He's not doing anything. And I don't deserve this. And Elihu says to Job, Job, if you persist in that, you do understand that that leads to destruction. That's the end of the story. But the righteous, he says, are actually delivered from their affliction by affliction. In other words, God takes that very issue of suffering, and through that very issue of suffering, does in their heart what was most needed. He takes the suffering and uses it like a scalpel, not to punish and destroy, but to correct and change and transform. And Job, there's your answer. That's who God is. Now let's just test it briefly against some other parts of Scripture. Because, right, theoretically, if that's the answer, if that's one of the answers, one of the things behind human suffering, surely we're going to see that elsewhere in Scripture. Let me just give you a few references. I won't spend tons of time. Hebrews 12, 1 Peter chapter 1, 2 Corinthians 1, and James 1. Four New Testament passages that lay out precisely the same argument. Let me just kind of highlight a couple of them. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 10 to 11, we're told there that God disciplines for our good, not for our punishment. Don't ever for a second fall into that path, I call it actually an error of saying, when I'm suffering, God's punishing me. Because if that was true, then Christ's death on the cross is an inadequate thing. And that can't be. Christ's death on the cross dealt with sin and punishment. But you see, we still have issues in our lives. I do. That God continually works and directs with a scalpel to address and cause growth. In fact, that's what Hebrews 12 goes on to say. It seems painful, but later it brings about the fruit of righteousness. Elihu is saying the same thing to Job. Exact same thing. Job, this suffering seems painful, but through the affliction, God is at work. And Job, now you're at this fork in the road. What are you going to do with this? Now that actually is the consistent message through those four passages. And that's actually sort of a funny thing. If you ever go read much of Martin Luther, he talked about there's three methods necessary to interpret the Bible correctly. In other words, if you take this book and say, I want to read it and understand it, Luther said, now he used German words, but the first is meditation. In other words, you've got to think about it. You can't just read it, set it on the shelf and go, I've done my bit. You have to read it and consider what you're reading. The second, he said, was prayer. You got to ask God to open your eyes. This is a living, active thing. You have to ask God to help you understand. And thirdly, was suffering. Actually, the word he used was a German word that means attack. You got to be attacked. And when you are, your ability to understand and comprehend God's word is transformed. Job's being attacked. He's coming to understand who God is. Now, if we're right, if I'm right, let me ask you just one last question. What else is necessary for Job? If Elihu comes and says, Job, here's how this is working. God is like a surgeon, so to speak, with a scalpel. And he's operating through your affliction. What's the only thing necessary? It's a nurse sitting there saying, Job, you can trust him. Job, you might not understand what's going on. It might even look like his hand is a bit shaky, but oh, Job, you don't understand how good, powerful, and wise God is. And if you did, you'd be able to rest your life in his hands. If you were to read from chapter 36, verse 24 to the end of chapter 37, and consider what Elihu says next, you would see he does exactly that. All he does for the next chapter and a half is says, Job, I just want to describe how amazing God is. Because Job, I know I'm asking a huge thing. I'm asking you to actually believe that what looks like it is chaotic and out of control is actually part of a perfect plan that God could be doing in your life. Behold, God is great. We know him not. His number of years is unsearchable. He draws up drops of water and distills the mist in rain, which the skies pour down and drop on mankind abundantly. Can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thundering of his pavilion? Behold, he scatters his lightning about him and covers the roots of the sea. For by these he judges people. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares his presence. The cattle declare that he rises. At this my heart trembles and leaps. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it go, and his lightning to the corners of the earth. After it, his voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice. For to the snow, he says, fall on the earth. Likewise to the downpour, his mighty downpour, he seals up the hand of every man, that all men whom he made may know it. Job, just stop for a moment and remember who God is. The lightning, the thunder that seems the greatest power that you can comprehend, God is directing the whole thing. And so Job, the affliction of your heart, you can trust this God. Let me pray for you. Father, thank you for your word. We know that when we come to